This 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Washington seeks to reassure Baghdad. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden telephoned Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi Monday, thanking Iraqi forces for, quote, their enormous sacrifice and bravery against Islamic State militants. On Sunday, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said Iraqi forces retreated from Ramadi last week because they had no will to fight. Stephen Zunis is a regional analyst with the University of San Francisco.
Unfortunately, what the Secretary of Defense said was pretty accurate. The Iraqi armed forces certainly were not up to the task in Ramadi. This has been a problem ever since the Bush administration decided to abolish the Iraqi army, which was a professional force, a secular nationalist bastion in that country, despite the abuses by the former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein.
Speaking to the BBC Monday, Prime Minister Abadi called Mr. Carter's comment about Iraqi forces misguided, saying Ramadi will be taken in days, not weeks. More Ahed government protests erupted across Burundi Monday, including the capital, Bujumbura. The opposition quit UN-brokered peace talks after the leader of the opposition, UPD party, Zedi Feruzi, and his bodyguard were killed in a shooting Saturday. The U.S. condemned that killing and urged Burundian authorities to arrest the perpetrators and protect other politicians. The crisis began last month when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he'll not run for a controversial third term. This protester says he's opposed to a third term, saying the killings of protesters and opposition politicians must stop. More than 20 have died in clashes between police and protesters since late last month. This is VOA News. A Tunisian soldier opened fire on his fellow troops Monday, killing at least 7, wounding 10, before he himself was shot. Authorities said the attack occurred at the Bouchoucha base in Tunis, not far from where 2 Islamist gunmen opened fire on tourists at the Bardo National Museum in March, killing 21. The soldier's motivation is not known. Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian goes on trial in Tehran Tuesday on spy charges in a court that is closed to the public, press, and family. Rezaian was arrested last July and has been in prison ever since. Jason's brother, Ali, spoke about the trial Monday.
By having a secret trial, a closed trial, it just shows how scared the Iranians are to show that there's evidence. I think they're embarrassed by the evidence they have. They've gone along with this sham for the last 10 months, and now they're going to have a trial, and they want to keep it as closed as possible. So there's less information for people to say, why have you held this person? He's totally innocent.
The charges against Rezaian are vague, and no one has said exactly on what and for whom he's accused of spying. Washington Post executive editor Martin Barron calls the case against the reporter shameful and absurd. Said the judge assigned to the case is known worldwide as a notorious human rights violator. Sunni militia fighters in Yemen dealt a blow to Shia Houthi rebels Monday, seizing a key military site in the southern city of Dale. The number of casualties is unclear. Meanwhile, there's no let-up in the Saudi-led airstrikes across Yemen and the capital, Sana'a. The outlook for peace is dim, with the fighting and airstrikes continuing. Yemeni and UN officials say a peace conference scheduled for Thursday has been indefinitely postponed. President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi, in exile in Saudi Arabia, has demanded Houthi rebels abide by a UN Security Council resolution and withdraw from territory seized before the talks can proceed. Violent storms raged Monday across the Mexico-Texas border, killing at least 11, injuring dozens more, flattening hundreds of homes. Searchers in Texas continue to look for a dozen people believed to have been swept away in flash flooding. In Nigeria, fuel wholesalers say they've reached an agreement with the government to resume fuel distribution, ending a crisis that brought airlines, banks, and phone companies to a standstill. They had stopped distributing fuel, saying the government owed them $1 billion. Government officials said the wholesalers had been fully paid. The shortage left domestic airlines grounded and gas stations dry. It also impacted banks and telephone companies who rely on a steady supply of diesel to power generators because of a shortage of public electricity. The crisis came just days before the inauguration of President-elect Muhammadu Buhari on Friday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An agreement has been reached to end Nigeria's crippling fuel strike.
It's a major threat to the economy, and Nigerians have come out to say this is a sabotage. This is an attempt to blackmail and hoodwink the incoming government. So I think it is because of that awkward position they found themselves that they have decided to shift ground.
Peter Akpatasin is the immediate past president of the Nigeria Union of Petroleum and Natural Gas Workers. An audit report says Nigeria's state oil company is unsustainable. Zimbabweans observed Africa Day yesterday, and residents of a town in eastern Congo go on a tax strike.
Residents of Beni, a town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, are on a tax strike following a series of massacres in the area. Local activists have called for the strike to go on until security is restored.
That's VOA correspondent Nick Long in Goma, Eastern Congo. And malnutrition is a big problem for South Sudan refugees in Uganda. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Nigeria, a major fuel strike, which left domestic airlines grounded, gas stations to run dry, and banks to close early, has been resolved. Fuel wholesalers have stopped distributing the commodity, alleging the government owed them $1 billion. Government officials had said the wholesalers had been fully paid. It is not clear what deal was negotiated in Monday's meeting. Peter Akpatasin is the immediate past president of the Nigeria Union of Petroleum and Natural Gas Workers. He's now a member of the House of Representatives, where he serves on the Petroleum Downstream Committee. He said the fuel distributors felt pressure to end their strike because if they didn't do so, Nigerians would hold them responsible for the collapse of the economy.
One of the reasons is that Nigerians, we've never had it this bad in the country. The effect on the economy is so monumental that they are feeling if they don't do this now, Nigerians may take arms against them. I think they are in that awkward position as we speak. The telephone network providers have given indication that in the next couple of hours, if the situation does not change, they might not be able to continue to serve us. Banks are now closing half day, and a lot of companies have giving warning that they will not be able to continue. So it's a major threat to the economy. And Nigerians have come out to say this is a sabotage. This is an attempt to blackmail and hoodwink the incoming government. So I think it is because of that awkward position they found themselves that they have decided to shift ground.
Was anything offered to anyone to solve this crisis?
No deal was offered except the understanding that the issue of subsidy will be looked into, and that where a genuine case of outstanding non-payment is discovered, such payments will be made. But this has to be subject to due process and proper verification.
As the immediate past president of the Oil Workers Union, how did Nigeria get to this crisis?
Well, the genesis of the whole thing is that over the years, the refineries have been neglected, and NNPC, the National Oil Company, has been so badly managed because of bureaucracy and lack of transparency to some extent. As a result of that, the four refineries in Nigeria are not producing up to maximum capacity. Therefore, we depend on importation of petroleum products.
So now you are a member of parliament, APC. Your party will be taking over the government on Friday, the 29th. The APC is accusing the Jonathan administration of manufacturing something. Is this fair to say that this is a political issue?
Absolutely. It is quite political. Yeah, because the figures they are panning up and down are quite outrageous, and it is difficult for anybody to justify such figures. And a lot of Nigerians believe that the strike itself was politically motivated both by the outgoing elements in the outgoing government who are owning some of these companies by proxy, as well as some of the associations who believe that now that a transparent president is coming in, the unjustified subsidies will not be paid. And so they have to put the government under severe pressure so that they'll be hoodwinked into paying the subsidy, whether there's justification for it or not. That is the kind of thing that is playing out in this case.
You said it's political, but you mentioned the lack of refineries in Nigeria and the government's continued payment of subsidies to keep prices down. Don't you think that perhaps Nigeria can solve this problem by building refineries in Nigeria?
Even the failure of the refinery is traceable to political, manipulations. You know, because the process of maintenance of the refinery, the process of management, the process of repairs and fixing the refinery has been so badly politicized to the extent that we believe that the refineries can do better than they are doing just now. Contracts are being awarded to cronies instead of experts. So Nigerians are fed up. Nigerians believe that we are spending so much money to fix these refineries and they are not working.
Peter Akpatterson is the immediate past president of the Nigeria Union of Petroleum and Natural Gas Workers. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Last month, the Nigerian government released a long-awaited audit on the state oil company, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, or the NNPC. The audit said Nigeria, Africa's biggest oil producer, needs to urgently overhaul the way it manages the company. Gillian Parker's reports from Johannesburg.
Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan commissioned PricewaterhouseCoopers to audit the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, NNPC, last year. He acted after firebrand Central Bank Governor Lamido Zanusi alleged that the state oil company failed to remit roughly $20 billion in oil revenues to government accounts. A leaked letter from the bank governor to the president highlighted the missing revenues and alleged that NNPC was operating in violation of the law and its leadership could not be trusted. The allegations sealed Zanussi's fate. He was suspended. But the audit appears to support many of his allegations. The 200-page report from PwC, released by the Nigerian presidency on Monday, stated the NNPC model of operation must be urgently reviewed and restructured as the current model, which has been in operation since the creation of the corporation, cannot be sustained. The auditors said the company has a blank check to spend money without limit or control. Accounting and monitoring systems for oil revenue appear to be inaccurate and weak. The report said that data sets are beleaguered with significant discrepancies. For instance, PwC found a minimum of $1.48 billion in computation errors and unsubstantiated costs. Olushan Olumide is co-founder of Lagos-based Budget, a non-profit organisation that analyses government budget figures. He says the NNPC is likely to owe even more to the Treasury and that another audit should take place once President-elect Muhammadu Buhari assumes office.
I think he has a political will strongly to do this. He is the first chairman of NNPC. He was even the Nigerian oil minister before, so he has a bit of understanding about this work. The only thing that I understand is that certain elements in this part might also not be interested in this kind of reform.
This is the biggest slush fund in Nigeria. It's not going to vanish overnight. What the incoming government is going to find is that temptations to keep it and to continue to use it as previous governments have done, that temptation is going to be immense. What we have seen is that, look, the NNPC would overwhelm any attempt to reform it.
One factor that may influence the debate is that the so-called slush fund is not as big as it used to be. The steep slide in oil prices over the past year has effectively emptied the government's coffers. Still, there is little doubt Mr. Buhari will have a tough time cleaning up a murky oil industry and the vested interests that benefit. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 26th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Residents of Beni, a town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, are on a tax strike following a series of massacres in the area. Local activists have called for the strike to go on until security is restored. Nick Long has more from Goma in the Eastern DRC.
Civil society groups in Beni Territory say the death toll from killings and massacres in the area since last October is now well more than 300. The United Nations believes Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels are mainly responsible for these atrocities. Government troops and UN peacekeepers have been engaged in heavy fighting against the ADF, suffering casualties but inflicting heavy losses on the rebels. The slaughter of 20 people in a suburb of Beni 2 weeks ago was the signal for another wave of protests. Citizens held demonstrations and stayed away from work for a week. The president of civil society groups in Beni town, Gilbert Kambali, then announced a change of tactics. He said for humanitarian reasons people should go back to work as they could not afford not to, and instead they should show their discontent by refusing to pay taxes. A spokesman for civil society in North Kivu province, Gento Maundu, told VOA the tax strike is nearly a week old and is continuing.
Les taxes ne sont pas payées pour l'avancement des taxes sur l'étalage. Il y a aussi des patentes qui ce n'est pas aussi payé.
He says the taxes that are not being paid are stallholder fees and some larger taxes paid by businesses to the DGI, the General Tax Office. He said some better off individuals in Beni who are more dependent on the government are still paying taxes to the DGI, but many other business people are not. A local journalist in Beni told VOA that most of the big annual taxes had already been paid for this year, and so far no one has been arrested for refusing to pay tax.
Les acteurs ou les activistes de la société civile sont menacés. Il y a des coups de téléphone anonymes.
Mandu says the civil society activists who called this protest have been threatened in anonymous phone calls and even directly in meetings, and he and his colleagues are very worried about this. Gilbert Kambali told VOA threats have included death threats against himself and six of his colleagues. He has asked the authorities to investigate the threats, he said, but without result. Meanwhile, as fear grips the area, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says 3,700 families have fled their homes in the past 3 weeks, most taking refuge in Beni and nearby towns. Some aid organizations have suspended their activities in the high-risk areas of Oicha and Eringeti north of Beni, but the UN Office says some aid workers are now going back to those areas. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Zimbabwe is one of only 5 African countries that observe Africa Day, May 25th, as a public holiday. However, and for many, the day does not inspire hope given the conflicts, poverty, and poor governance that they say the day was set out to prevent. Toraya Shava of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports from Bulawayo.
As the continent marks Africa Day, a day to remember and reflect on the founding in 1963 of the Organization of African Unity, now the African Union, some Zimbabweans wonder if African unity can ever be a reality. Speaking in Bulawayo, in a series of discussions hosted by a non-governmental organization, Bulawayo Agenda to Observe Africa Day, the leader of one faction of the Movement for Democratic Change, Welshman Mwewe, said despite a checkered history that includes slavery, colonialism, as well as post-independence maladministration, Africans have to remain hopeful about the future, as not doing so would be equal to giving up on themselves.
I remain optimistic that African people will eventually prevail and that we'll be able to build a brand of democracy which accepts the dignity and integrity of every individual.
John Gomo, a lecturer at Rhodes University in South Africa, who also participated in the same discussion, argued that it is difficult for some people to be optimistic about Africa's future, as its problems have been persisting in spite of many global interventions to stop them.
What makes me rather pessimistic is the fact that there have been lots of efforts, initiatives at a global level whereby rights of minority groups have been pronounced. Yet, we continue to see these problems.
Some observers and Pan-Africanist pundits also say because of President Mugabe's former Pan-Africanist ideals, he will be able to make significant strides towards the unification of Africa. But Director Meli Dube of Law Agenda does not share the same view. Dube thinks that Mr. Mugabe's age and his tainted human rights record do not show that he will be able to unite Africans before handing over the AU and SADC chair to another president.
As the civil war in South Sudan rages on, more than 100,000 refugees have fled to camps in neighboring Uganda. The United Nations Children's Fund says $36 million is needed to meet the basic needs of the refugees. Sergino Rusblad has more from a camp in northern Uganda.
By now, Akong Chiong knows how to prepare the nutritious plum peanut for her twin daughters. It's a peanut-based product with extra nutrients for children who are severely malnourished. A few months ago, the two babies were underfed and in dire condition. Luckily, there was help in the refugee camp where they were born and where their mother has been living since 2013. For many other children at the Rhino refugee settlement in Uganda's Arua district, malnourishment remains a serious problem. The camp holds about 90,000 refugees. Relief workers like Joseph Mbabasi say about 20% of the children are malnourished.
The biggest issue here is high rates of severe acute malnutrition, especially among children below 5 years. Basically, with malnutrition, it's not cosmetological, so you can't see it. You need to assess the child. But when you get to see it in the visible form, that means it is in the severest form.
Nearly 2 million people have been displaced from their homes since South Sudan's civil war began in late 2013. At the moment, 136,000 live in the camps across Uganda, more than two-thirds of them women and children. Here at the refugee camp's health center, children are continuously being screened for malnutrition. This girl's condition is unfortunately not satisfactory. She needs to stay on supplements and return in a week to see whether she has gained enough weight. Apart from screening children, UNICEF and the aid group Concern Worldwide hold training sessions for mothers, teaching them how to detect malnutrition and hopefully prevent it. Akong Tion says it's here where she learned how to make a nutritious meal for her children.
I was taught how to make porridge for my two young babies and also how to make tomato juice for them. That's why the children are better now.
The European Commission recently donated 1 million euros for the camps, an amount which is still far from the $36 million needed to meet the refugees' basic needs. Still, UNICEF's Jerry Dyer says the organization is thankful for the donation.
We are feeling the pressure as the rest of the world is. Just look at what's just recently happened in Nepal. Unfortunately, the unfolding crisis in Burundi. We are definitely feeling the pressure. The nutrition program is a very expensive program, but it's one of the most important. A child being able to have water, a child being able to have a full stomach, it's about the dignity of these people.
With no ending to the South Sudan conflict in sight, the pressure on these camps may go on for months or years to come. Serginho Rosblat for VOA News, Arua, Uganda.
Private investors are breathing life into areas of downtown Johannesburg that have long suffered from a legacy of violence and criminality. The famous Point building, marking the Johannesburg skyline, was once notorious for crime and squatters. But now, and as Gillian Parker reports, there is a waiting list to live there.
Downtown Johannesburg was once the stomping ground for wealthy magnates during the gold rush in the 1880s. But as the city erupted with crime and anti-apartheid violence in the 1970s, the white middle class scampered to the plush northern suburbs, taking their businesses with them. Poor migrants moved into abandoned buildings. Parts of the inner city became so-called grey zones outside the government's jurisdiction. Today, private investors are slowly restoring pockets of the city once settled with the reputation of violence, drug lords and squalor. CEO Jonathan Liebman of Propertuity, a commercial development firm, saw potential in Mabineng, an area near the central business district that was strewn with derelict industrial relics. He said, "It occurred to me that there was something missing in the city. There was no real connection to the CBD." He developed 5 decaying warehouses into Arts on Main in 2009. Fashion events and a Sunday market selling art, craft beer and vintage clothing draw hundreds of people to the area. Propertuity now owns 50 former commercial buildings and has redeveloped 20. His latest endeavour attracted distinguished architect David Ajayi, who redesigned Hallmark House, a 17-storey building that once hosted diamond polishers. Opening less than 2 months ago, two-thirds of the building has already been sold. Minimalist open-plan apartments boast impressive views of the city. Penthouses go for around $300,000. Neil McCarroll, sales manager at Propertuity, who also owns an apartment in the precinct, says prices have doubled since 2009.
When I was younger, you just didn't used to come in here, and Joburg was like a swear word. Joburg's becoming a very, very cool place to come out. In terms of investments, obviously very attractive, but then you join the younger, trendier people.
There is an insatiable demand for housing from low, middle income earners, says urban planner Tanya Zak.
It's a segment that's not provided for elsewhere. generally that segment falls into what's called the gap market. So they don't qualify for government subsidies because they earn too much, but they don't earn enough to qualify for bank loan, for mortgage finance. So there's been a huge demand and willing developers to go in and transform buildings, and there have been buildings that have sorely needed that kind of transformation.
Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's 25 minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Olma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Tournament underdogs Mozambique, Madagascar, Botswana and Namibia emerged victorious at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup quarterfinals at the Moruleng Stadium and Royal Bafokeng Sports Palace in Pokeng in Northwest Province in South Africa. On Monday, Mozambique pipped Malawi 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout following their 2-2 draw at the end of open play. Still in Pokeng, Madagascar edged guest side Ghana 2-1. Early on Sunday in Moruleng, Botswana held their nerves to edge South Africa 7-6 in a sudden-death penalty shootout, while Namibia eliminated defending champions Zambia 5-4 in a penalty shootout. On a positive note, Liberia can now stage football matches, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, General Secretary Hicham El Amrani disclosed in Cairo, Egypt. Last August, CAF suspended football activities in the Mano River region as a measure to curb the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. This meant Liberia, Guinea and Sierra Leone played their home matches at neutral venues. The United Nations World Health Organization's WHO has declared Liberia Ebola-free, thus paving the way for the resumption of football in Liberia. Guinea and Sierra Leone have not received the WHO's clearance and so continue to play their home matches at neutral venues. In Olympic news, hosts Zambia pipped Zimbabwe 2-1 in women's 2016 Olympic football qualifiers in Lusaka on Sunday. Egypt and Ghana drew 1-1. South Africa edged Gabon 3-2. Equatorial Guinea outclassed Republic of Congo 3-0. And Botswana pipped Kenya 2-1. Elsewhere, Sierra Leone and Cameroon drew 0-0, as did Zimbabwe and Swaziland in men's 2016 Olympic football qualifiers on Sunday. Tunisia edged Sudan 1-0. Mauritania and Mali drew 1-1, as did Botswana and Zambia. Uganda edged Rwanda 2-1, as Ghana pipped Republic of Congo 1-0. Finally, in rugby, hosts Netherlands beat South Africa 17-7 to place 11th at the sixth and final leg of the women's IRB Sevens tournament in Amsterdam on Sunday. At the end of this first season in the women's Sevens series, South Africa are 12th with 8 points. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Cape Town, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa News. Nigeria's fuel wholesalers say they have reached a deal with the government to resume fuel distribution, ending a crisis that brought airlines, banks, and phone companies to a standstill. The fuel wholesalers have stopped distributing the commodity, alleging the government owed them $1 billion. Government officials had said the wholesalers had been fully paid. Police and anti-government protesters clashed again Monday in Burundi as the United States and United Nations urged all parties to get back to peace talks. The opposition quit the talks after the leader of the UPD party, Zeda Feruzi, and his bodyguard were killed in a shooting in Bujumbura on Saturday. That's it for this Tuesday, May 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post-editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.